Hey, it's Alan from Best Biome. April 25th, we are premiering a brand new podcast. Part of our mission at Grassland Groupies is getting adults connected with environmental education and science, so we've decided to produce an ecology podcast for adults. It's called Filthy Animals, and like its title suggests, it's going to cover some of the fun, fascinating, and, well, filthy aspects of the natural world. Sex, drugs, violence, and everything else your high school science teacher may have been too embarrassed to tell you about.
Cowards.
As nature nerds, this is a big passion project of ours. We are very excited to bring it to you. Keep an eye out for Filthy Animals, premiering April 25th, wherever you find the best biome.
Hello from your favorite Grasslands PR team. This week, we're back with another reason why this overlooked and underappreciated ecosystem is objectively the best biome. I'm Rachel.
I'm Nicole.
And I'm Alan. And today we're going to be taking another trip back to Africa with you and me, dear friends. And you, listener. I like to think you're a dear friend as well. We've known each other for a while now.
So that's true.
I count you among my besties.
Oh.
We are going to also revisit a topic that is within the same, you know, family of an episode we did earlier. Last season, we talked about baboons, a grasslands primate. We talked all about how, you know, they actually eat a shocking amount of grass in their diet. The savanna is their home. We're going to be talking about a couple of other monkeys that also live in these environments. Have a significant ecological importance to the world.
World.
To the whole world.
Is it people?
The whole world?
Is it people?
Yeah.
People aren't monkeys.
True.
Oh, that's true. We don't have tails.
Not all monkeys have tails either.
Are Saiyans?
Saiyans?
Like, yeah. Super Saiyans?
Saiyans are aliens, yes. not primates.
Yeah.
Okay. I knew that. Something in my head was like.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
You know, where did the seed come from that planted their DNA on their planet?
That's a good point. All right. This is not a Dragon Ball podcast. It could be, though, I guess, if
no.
you want it to be.
Nope.
So the Pottis monkey is a fairly cool, it's, you know, it's within the same family as baboons, obviously. There are two other sort of ground-dwelling monkeys that exist on the savannas of sub-Saharan Africa that are somewhat closely related to baboons. You've got Chlorocebus, which would be vervets, and Erythrocebus, which are the Pottis monkeys. If you know your Greek, this would be basically red and green monkeys is what their genus names mean.
Wow.
So vervets are greenish looking, and Pottis monkeys are like a bright orange color. These are long-tailed monkeys. They're built very different than a lot of other monkeys. They're very clearly ground-dwelling. They have like what they call like hind limb drive, you know? So it's like if you were like buying a car, it's like they have like more pronounced hind limbs because they like have a pretty high ground speed.
Fascinating.
Yes. The reason I wanted to talk about Pottis monkeys today is because there is a fascinating bit of ecology. Like, you know, we talked about how baboons are really extraordinary generalists. Vervets are as well. They have a very broad diet, almost as broad as like humans would be, right? True omnivores, eat a little bit of everything, occupy really complex kind of mosaic habitats. Not so for Pottis monkeys. They are very connected to certain kinds of habitats in the savanna and actually have a very, very close relationship with one particular tree. Yes. So it's like a very tight symbiosis. And this tree, which we'll get to in a minute, is like there's some really strange ecology behind this tree as well that I want to get into. So this won't just be like a primate episode. We're going to be talking a little bit about plants. We are going to be talking a little bit about bugs. It's going to be very fun.
Amazing.
This is part, the next phase in my campaign to get Nicole to enjoy hearing anything about primates.
Uh-huh. I'm excited.
Yes.
Because of the bugs.
Yeah,
if that needs to be said. Okay.
Great job. Yeah, yeah.
So, talking a little bit more about what is a pottus monkey. Like I said, they are the ground-dwelling monkeys of the savannah. They are quadrupedal, so they run on all fours, but they do stand up, like on their back legs when they eat and like look at danger. Is that alarming?
Yes.
They're not that tall.
Doesn't matter.
It's not weird.
It is weird.
These are like baby monkeys, though. These are pretty small.
Puntable.
Why would you phrase it like that?
It's a valid question.
I mean, maybe, yeah, if you got like a good, you know, if you really got some good contact with it, probably. Okay. Like the females are about like 10 to 15 pounds. The males are like 15 to 22-ish pounds. Okay. So these are pretty small. Like they're not big critters. Mm-hmm. House cat sized, really.
That's a pretty big house cat. But yes, I think that is...
Well, okay, yeah, that would be a hefty house cat for the males, but yeah, yeah. they live in pretty open habitats, and the range that we're talking about, like there is a swath of Central Africa north of the equator, and these like basically east to west across the continent, pottus monkeys can be found okay. from like the western coast, like Senegal, all the way to like western Ethiopia. So like they have a wide geographical range. Mm-hmm. They also are really well adapted to like not only the dry savannas, but they can almost kind of reach into like the southern edges of the Sahara Desert.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So these are good dry environment monkeys. So a pottus monkey habitat typically is going to look like a grass savanna or you know, more of like a dry, sparse woodland with lots of tall grass, as long as it has that one particular tree there.
What tree?
We're going to talk about it in a second.
We're ready. I want to know the tree.
We're going to talk about the monkey first. Okay. Talk about the monkey first.
I know the tree, and I know the bug.
Oh, settle down. Of course you do.
Haven't you mentioned the pottus monkey before? Because I feel like we had a whole discussion about how it's spelled and if it's spelled like pothos plants.
Oh, no, it's not. It's P-A-T-A-S. Pottus.
Okay. We totally talked. Okay. We like mentioned them before.
I have no idea.
We probably did mention them in the baboon episode. Because they share the same habitat. Mm-hmm. You know, there's even some possible baboon conflicts with these monkeys.
I knew it.
We mentioned that they do not have a very diverse diet compared with baboons and vervets. Instead, they are what could be termed an obligate gumivore.
What?
A gumivore. They are a gumivorous mammal, which means they eat tree gum.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
Is that weird?
Xanthan gum? Do they have just really good quality teeth?
No cavities. No, you're right. Like it's a similar like byproduct of a tree that they're eating.
Okay.
Gum arabic would be like the product that is derived from what they are eating.
Oh.
So yeah. Okay, and that actually constitutes as much as 80% of their caloric intake would be the gum, seeds, flower, fruit, and insects associated with that tree.
That's such a wide range of things to eat. Usually when you think of a specialist, you think of, you know, a specific plant only. Mm-hmm. But that's like every part of the plant and also its ecosystem.
And that's true. Like, but it's, you know, I think the gum itself typically comprises as much as like 40 or 50% on its own.
Dang.
Wow. Okay. And then all the other little bits that come with it. But they are like intensely linked to that tree. So real quickly talk about their social behaviors before we move on to the ecological connection to the tree. It's worth noting that the pottus monkeys, a little bit different than like, or somewhat similar to baboons, live in typically single male groups. Okay. The average of what I found, these groups range from like 5 to 79 monkeys, which is not really a helpful number at all.
Yeah,
it's like, why can you not pare that down to an average? Uh-huh. That's really insane.
Is it because they do have a large range and some of those are really dry areas? Is it just based on food availability or is it more complicated?
Or is it like, do they have a town versus do they have a bachelor herd?
Yeah. Well, and there are like, there are the, so you have like the single male groups with like a sort of like harem situation happening. Mm-hmm. And then you would have, you do have like either solitary males or bachelor groups that also wander around. Okay. And there's also that fission fusion thing happening that tends to happen with a lot of monkeys.
Okay.
Where they sort of like, they come together, form temporary groups, and then split up. You know, like a one group will take in a number of males during the wet season when it's mating time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then they'll kind of go their own ways, that sort of thing.
Gotcha.
Cool.
They're not like, there's not a super clear, or at least not well-researched social hierarchy. There seems to be like a strong social hierarchy amongst like female monkeys and the male monkeys. There is like some fighting like that will happen, but not really like violent combat. There's usually like open mouth sort of threatening and calling and like posturing. Sometimes they'll sneak attack each other and just like jump on the back and bite somebody and then jump off again.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
yeah, it doesn't get much crazier than that. They do actually have the longest canines of old world monkeys, the old world tailed monkeys. Yeah, and that canine length may actually be kind of a factor in like their society. Like, whoa, big teeth.
Longest or longest in proportion to their body?
This, good question. I think it's, this says longest. Okay. So, I mean, yeah. Compared with like, but I guess you'd think like, I don't know if that, how that compares with like mandrels and stuff like that.
Yeah. That was the first, I was like, they're scary.
Mandrels are scary. Yeah. It's a good question. I'll need to clarify that.
Okay.
Thank you for asking, Nicole.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just need to know how scared of this monkey I need to be.
You don't need to be too scared of it.
Okay.
Like you said, it's puntable.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for bringing me back down.
They're not a...
if you punted a tooth that's huge, you could puncture yourself
just
on
go right
it,
through
you
know? Your
true.
Foot.
That's true. These monkeys are not terribly aggressive, though.
That's good.
When it, you know, they are definitely... they tend to... They tend to default to the flight sort of rather than the fight.
Until they turn around and jump on your back.
Yeah. Well, you know, just don't try to steal their mates. So.
Okay.
yeah, relax, Nicole. They are very, very fast, though, for a primate. They are actually the fastest in terms of, like, ground speed, fastest primate. They get up to 55 kilometers an hour. That is 34 miles an hour. Which is, that's quick. That is like the, as fast as a leopard, you know, so they can move if they need to. Mm-hmm. And they hit that speed pretty quickly in like 3 seconds or so. So, you know,
jeez.
They hear that alarm call and it's like, whoop, zoop, and they're out of there. And like sick. A lot of other monkeys, they, you know, run quickly and then get into a tree. Mm-hmm. And that's the plan. They have been observed to like, sometimes mob attackers if like their numbers will permit it. Mm-hmm. Things like hyenas or jackals typically more like solitary predators, they will like sort of encircle them and harass them, and it's like, oh, I've made a mistake, there's 79 monkeys here.
Yeah.
I'm gonna leave. Typically they tend to default to running, and they are highly, highly mobile in general. That's kind of an interesting thing about them. They move across the savanna to a degree which, you know, you'd expect for like larger herbivores, I guess. Mm-hmm. They just kind of move and, you know, graze. They eat quickly. They look for like convenient access foods, just like grasshopper, yoink, yoink, yoink. You know, like, oh, here's my tree. And then like snack on that and then move on. They cover around 3 to 4 kilometers per day.
Wow.
In search of food, and have a home range that is anywhere from 32 to 40 kilometers or 12 to 15 square miles. So to put that in perspective for you, that is greater than the home range of a coyote or a white-tailed deer. And that is equivalent in daily movement to a pronghorn.
Wow.
So they are very mobile. They cover a lot of ground in the savanna when they are grazing, searching for food. And then, yeah, they, you know, they like to, they definitely prefer, like I said, the company of this one particular tree. Mm-hmm. It's very essential to them. They like to find the tallest stands of that favorite tree so they can scan for predators from it. you know, that's a sort of gives them a little bit of an advantage if they are, you know, going to get jumped. I read somewhere that the male monkeys will also do like a little distracting dance to try and bait predators away from the females.
Why are you doing crab rave over here?
I don't know. That's kind of what I picture it like. Pontus monkeys are sometimes referred to as like dancing monkeys because they do like get real jumpy when they're excited.
Oh my gosh. That's really cute.
So that's kind of what their like life history is like. Mm-hmm. You know, they all split up at night, go find their own tree to sleep in, diffuse the risk, you know. Mm. And then they all come back together at dawn and they're like, sweet, let's get a move on. Find that sweet, tasty snack tree. That sweet, tasty snack tree is, Nicole, as I'm sure you're aware, the whistling thorn acacia.
Whistling thorn acacia. Why are you wiggling your eyebrows at me?
Why not?
The whistling thorn acacia. This is a tree that is very common to East and Central Africa's savannas, the rangelands of... It's actually kind of like getting to a point where it's almost like a little bit of a woody encroachment situation on some of sub-Saharan Africa's rangelands, because it's a hardy tree. It's an economically valuable tree. It's well fire adapted. So like, if it gets chopped, coppiced, I guess is the term for it.
Coppiced?
Yeah. Like when you like chop a tree down to like stumps.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But then it's like, boop, boop, boop. New little stems pop out of the stump, mm-hmm. comes right back. So it does. It handles disturbance very, very well, deals with like crown burning. Comes back from that pretty well as well. So it is, a hardy tree. Sometimes you'll see like small, like very short stands of them. Sometimes you'll see them being up to like 12, 15 feet tall in like sort of higher, you know, taller groupings. Gotcha. Which is where you would find Pontus monkeys, mm-hmm. right?
Do they sleep up in the trees? I don't remember if you mentioned that.
They sleep in any tree. They don't tend to sleep. I don't know how well they sleep in these particular trees because they look way uncomfortable. if you look at a whistling thorn acacia, they get at every single node on the branches, particularly the young branches. So like you'd see with, you know, an Osage orange tree or a honey locust, massive thorns, two thorns at every single node of every young branch. If you look at a picture of these, they are way, way pointy. Like it is, it's really, it's a vicious looking tree, honestly, but they do climb them. It's like the sort of the main trunks, like the main stems aren't as thorny, kind of like, you know, they get more mature. Like you'd see with a honey locust, right? The older, more mature parts of the tree don't have those thorns.
Gotcha.
It's all herbivory defense, right?
Yeah.
And that's why you got to protect those like little baby branches.
Yeah, that's the delicious, delectable, desirable part of the tree.
Indeed.
Arm yourself.
Arm yourself. Yes, this tree is quite pointy. It is a mimosid tree, so it's in the mimosa family. You know, so it's like a
pom-pom firecracker flowers.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah, no, really like puffy, like stringy looking flowers.
Yeah. Very Horton Hears a Who.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's got very like complex leaflets, lots of tiny little leaflets, like, you know, 20 or 30 on like a little almost fern like kind of leaf.
Okay. What color is the flower
of this tree? I actually didn't look.
I'm gonna guess
the
pink
flowers.
pink
a lot probably of pink. There's a pink. Lot of them seem to be pink, right?
Fuchsia. Pink is what I'm picturing.
Oh no, they're not. They are interesting. These are more, well, those are kind of young buds. They're actually more like a pale yellow.
Pale yellow.
Yeah. So not super colorful. But, you know, maybe they don't need those bold colors because it's not, you know, they're relying on different kinds of insects, I think. They have a tight symbiotic relationship with a different kind of insect. So before we get into that, though, because the ecology of this tree is truly fascinating, need to make sure we talk about why it's called the whistling thorn acacia.
Yeah.
Because these thorns tend to be, not all the thorns on the tree, but a lot of them tend to have a very bulbous base. They develop like a thick kind of like bubble, you know, underneath each thorn. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like just becomes swollen, right? This is what would be called a domatia. Okay, that's a domatia.
Okay.
Yes.
What is that?
What is that? Yes. It is basically habitat that the plant is creating for an insect. Now, this is in contrast with a gall, right? Because mm-hmm. that's kind of what they look like. If you look at what one of the thorns, one of the swollen thorns looks like, it does have that kind of a gall-like appearance. There's an example.
Oh, it does look like a gall.
But the important difference here is that a gall is a reaction that the plant has to an invader.
Mm-hmm.
The domatia is something a plant is putting out to attract an insect.
I didn't know this was a thing that existed. That is so cool.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So what they're looking for to occupy those little shelters all along the thorny branches are ants. Whistling thorn acacia is a well-known myrmecophyte, which is the fun term for ant plant. They have a very close mutualistic relationship with several species of ant on the African savanna. Now, these ants, of course, will lay eggs and you know, feed larvae inside the these little domatia inside the thorns, and then they'll burrow out, and then that leaves lots of little holes in the thorn bases, which creates the whistling sound as mm-hmm. the wind blows through these trees. So that's where they get their name.
So good.
Oh, that's so cool. That is so cool. What a neat tree.
It is a neat tree. Let's yes, and okay, so Nicole.
Yes.
Are you ready to take this journey with me?
Yeah, no more monkeys, only trees. Let's go.
All right, well, we're going to come back to the monkey. But first of all, this tree, okay? Because this tree is cool. All right, the whistling thorn acacia has a close symbiotic relationship with four species of ant. All right? The tree gives them a lot in this mutualistic relationship. It not only gives them the habitat from the domatia, it also gives them nectaries. So it will sort of put on and produce these little like nectar glands at the base of leaves to encourage ants to, you know, come and hang out. It will also produce something called Beltian bodies. Have you ever heard of this, Nicole?
I feel like I have, but do I remember what it is? No.
No, and why would you? It's a weird thing. Beltian bodies. This is something that's specific to species of acacia. And basically what they are detachable tips found on the pinules, or like the very tippity-top-tippities of these leaflets.
Okay.
So they put out little detachable tips on their leaves that are actually very rich with lipids, sugars, and proteins.
Oh, little snack packs for the ants.
Little snack packs on the tips of their leaves, yes.
Oh, my gosh. Cool. And if it's like a, you know, compound leaf with a million leaflets, that's so many little snacks.
Yeah, you'll look at like a picture of an acacia plant with the Beltian bodies, and you'll see like these little almost like golden tips on every little single leaflet. And yeah, it's a important food source for these ants. Now, a weird fun fact, because acacia trees are not limited to Africa. There are species of them elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a species of Central American acacia where another organism, the Bagheera Kiplingi, subsists almost entirely on those Beltian bodies. Do you want to guess what's weird about Bagheera Kiplingi?
They're lizards.
Is it a monkey?
Weirder than that.
They are possum. Baby spiders.
They are a spider. Yeah. They're a jumping spider. They are a jumping spider that eats Beltian bodies and nectar, composing almost 90% of its diet, making it effectively the world's lone herbivorous spider.
Whoa. I was going to say.
Out of all 40,000 species.
Yeah. I thought that carnivory was like a trait of spiders.
Yeah. Right. They're not even sure how it's able to eat the plants. They haven't actually, it has not been thoroughly researched yet. It's such a strange anomaly that this acacia-dwelling jumping spider eats almost entirely plants.
Wow.
Yeah. Whoa. It's weird.
Wow. I'm just, hang on, give me a minute. I have to digest this.
Right? Okay. No, right. This is where I was at, like at 5 o'clock this morning. I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. Anyway, there's some weird ecology that comes along with acacia trees is what I'm getting at. So what does the acacia tree get from the ants? One might wonder.
Defense.
Absolutely. That is it. Sorry, so You know, as if the thorns weren't like enough of a deterrent to large herbivores, they're still going to try to like, because it's just like, you know, they're the snack tree, right? They're a tasty tree. So anything from elephants to giraffes are going to try and nibble on this whistling thorn acacia. And as they begin to pull on the branches out of these bulbous domatia, these bulbous thorns begin pouring very aggressive ants that are very interested in defending their tree. And then they will just flood the face and nostrils of these large herbivores. Now, these ants are, most of them are in the Chromatogaster genus, which is the cocktail ant, or they're sometimes called the acrobat ant, because they have like a little heart-shaped thorax, and then they will like whoop, like handstand, boom, like bend their thorax up in a defensive posture, and just sort of like froth venom out,
nice,
like against an attacker. So imagine like, you know, several thousand ants doing that into your face all at once, as a giraffe, and
horrific.
Yeah, it's not great. So, yeah, that tends to be a pretty solid deterrent.
Yeah. Do these ants only live in the acacias, or do they live out just in the savannas? Are they specifically adapted to only be there?
So there are four species of ant that have like eight that are specifically adapted to this tree.
Like obligate.
Like it is like their host plant. And that's the next thing I wanted to talk about, because these ants, these four species of ants are like in a constant turf war for these trees. It is like a nonstop battle.
That tracks.
Yeah, like because all these ants, they want basically exclusive ownership of the individual tree.
Well, sure. Yeah, of course.
You know, they don't want to be competing with all these other frothy, angry critters. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So they try to battle it out as best they can. Now, what's kind of cool is the way this turf war plays out. So we're going to talk real just briefly about each of the four ants, because they have a very different strategy when it comes to dominating the tree and pushing out the competition. Okay. So the first one, and this is a study, this all comes from a study that was done in Kenya, where they looked at whistling thorn acacias and did some experimental treatments of them to see, sort of peg down some of the ecological relationships here. First species, this is sort of the top dog. They occupy around 52% of the whistling, you know, so they've got like the largest market share. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like the boss.
Biggest turf.
Yep, they got the biggest turf. This is Chromatogaster mimosae. The domatia that they find on these thorny branches are like a really key aspect of their colony life, and nectar is their key food source. So as such, they are extremely aggressive defenders of these trees. When it comes to other ant settlers, they will just like be full on ready for battle. Now, the other ants are a little different. Chromatogaster gyrstekeri sjostetai. That's like some Dutch guy, I'm assuming.
Okay.
These occupy about 15% of the trees, but they are much less vicious defenders compared with the mimosae species. Instead of relying on the domatia for the nesting habitat, what they do is they actively seek holes in the tree that are excavated by a pest species. Okay, so they look for tree holes to like start their colonies that were made by boring beetles.
Okay.
All right, long-horned boring beetles. These next guys have a bit of a different strategy. This would be the Chromatogaster nigriceps, also at about 15% of the share of trees. These two get easily outcompeted by the other Chromatogaster species. So the way they handle it is they will actually try to reduce contact and access between the trees they occupy by modifying the tree itself. So they will go around and they will cut parts of the tree off. They will chop off auxiliary buds. They will chop off apical meristems, you know, like the growth zones of the plants. They will chop these parts of the tree off, basically prune the tree so that it can't come into contact with the trees around it.
Nice.
So they will like build a little like moat around their tree by snapping the branches off.
Oh my gosh.
And that's how they keep the invaders away.
They're just exceptional gardeners.
It's very fun. And the last of the four species is not a chromatogaster species. It's a kind of slender ant, which are very like aptly named. If you look at a picture of it, it's like each segment of its body is like very long. And it's all like kind of like just one like very straight line. They have a really weirdly boxy head too. I don't know. If you look at ant heads too long, it gets like, it gets odd.
Yeah.
But you look at the whole ant, it's very cute. You look at just the head, it starts freaking you out a little bit.
Yeah.
When was the last time you stared at an ant head?
Ants are cool.
They're cool.
You didn't answer my question.
I don't know. Probably pretty recently. I mean, actually really recently. Yeah. Like last week.
See, that feels right.
Yeah.
That
it's winter. Right.
Well, it was the pictures online.
Yeah, okay.
He looked at pictures online.
Yeah. You got to wait for the, yeah. They'll be back soon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
this species is called Tetrapronera pinzigi. And this ant does not actually eat the nectar of the acacia tree. It doesn't care about that. So it goes full scorched earth. it will attack the nectar centers of the acacia plant.
Oh, wow.
To force other ants away from it. That is its strategy. It will basically just destroy any reward that the other ants might get for coming to this plant.
Poor tree.
No, it's still fine. The tree is still like okay with it. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is a mutualistic relationship, Rachel. Mm-hmm. You have to remember.
Mm-hmm.
These slender ants, okay, what do they get by forfeiting all these nectar rewards? They actually subsist on various items from the surface of the tree. So this could include everything from fungal hyphae to pollen spores. They don't actually eat other insects. They're not a carnivorous ant. Mm-hmm. So they're just kind of like a weird little scavenger. It just finds everything it needs inside these domatia and everything.
It really feels like more of these guys could coexist if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Well.
Especially if one's not using the nectar rewards. Why can't you just relax?
That's just not how ants work, I guess. It's true. They're just out for blood.
Yeah. If you ever have an ant problem, just find a nearby non-related anthill. Pick up some of that third in your anthill that's bothering you.
Uh-huh.
They'll destroy each other.
There you go.
It's really effective.
Initiate a war.
They're built for battle. Well, I mean, hey, they're like a eusocial species that will it's like, you know, we defend our own.
Right.
Get out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hey, it's better than pesticides, so.
True. There you go.
Very true.
Nature
it's a little barbaric, but so is pesticides. So
is nature. All right. Mm. Yeah. Sometimes. Okay. Now, Rachel, you said this poor tree. Well, here's an interesting note about that tree.
Okay.
From that 2008 study that they did on Kenya, where they put acacia, some of these acacia trees in enclosures where large herbivores did not have access to them. What they found was that the trees started doing worse. The fitness of these trees decreased in the absence of large herbivores. They would actually cease putting out the bulbous thorns. They would stop creating the domatia. They would stop creating the nectaries. The sort of like genetic mechanism for putting these ant-friendly, you know, features out onto a mature tree never gets triggered if there's not a disturbance from large herbivores.
Oh, weird. Is it like epigenetic?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, weird. Yeah. Okay.
The one exception to that is in trees that were populated with the Chromatograster nigriceps. That's the gardener one, the choppy, pruny ones who cut off parts of the tree. That still triggered that genetic mechanism of putting out the ant-friendly stuff because there was disturbance happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the tree needs to be damaged in order to put out, you know, these structures. Now, when there are no domatia, the ant populations begin to fall off, right? Which leads to all sorts of other issues. Now, the mimosa ones, the ones that have the top-notch, like top dog market share, they're the most aggressive competitors. Their population begins to fall off a little bit if there's no nectar to be had. Mm-hmm. So the ones that take over are the C. gerstekeri, the ones that look to fill the cavities created by boring beetles, which means they start facilitating more boring beetles to come to the trees. So without that competition, suddenly the acacia stands are getting overwhelmed by pests, which decreases the fitness as well.
Dang.
Another thing that happens.
Oh my gosh. It doesn't stop.
The mimosid ants, without any nectar to turn to on the acacia plants, instead change up their feeding strategy completely, and they begin tending scale bugs instead.
Oh, no.
So scale bugs, they're like, all right, fine. You won't give me any nectar. I'm going to get my nectar from these guys.
Yeah.
The scale bugs, they start damaging the tree, and they produce honeydew. As these scale bugs feed on the plant material itself, they produce a very sugary byproduct, which is essentially milked from them by the ants. They're like little livestock. And then they feed on the sugary water from these scale bugs. So, again, basically without the disturbance early on to put out these ant-friendly structures, mm-hmm. the ants go haywire. And the nature of the relationship changes. Mm-hmm. They become almost parasitic to the tree as opposed to mutualistic. Mm-hmm. So it's a very strange, like, delicate balance, the ecology of this tree.
And it's so intricate, this cascade that just happens with all these impacts just piling up on each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just because they didn't get eaten early on. Like, no herbivores ate them.
Yeah, they just didn't. There wasn't enough disturbance to, Yeah, it's weird. It's very strange.
And the tree just kind of turns on the ants, and the ants turn on the tree, and, like, the warfare just... But they're friends. Oh, I hate it. I love nature. It's so great.
It is really cool. The symbiotic relationships are fascinating. There is also another issue with introduced big-headed ants becoming a problem for these trees. Just throwing another ant into the gang war is it's really creating some issues for acacia trees and ants in general. So
are these are non-native?
They are non-native. Where are they? Do you know where big-headed ants come from? They're like all over the world.
Yeah, I don't know.
Probably Europe.
Maybe, right, yeah. I'm not really sure what their point of origin is.
British ants.
Okay. Ecology of this tree is very fascinating. The one thing I wanted to talk about with this tree before we move back into Monkey Town is the smaller scale effects that this has. Okay, so all these ants affect the ecosystem of the tree, like the microbiome, basically, of the tree as well. Mm-hmm. There's a study that found that the composition of the fungal community inside the tree changes drastically depending on what species has taken it over. They all take different approaches to modifying the habitat inside the tree. They contribute different substrates for nesting. They make, the trimming, the weeding, the grooming, the secreting that they do has very specific, like, creates very specific changes in the temperature and humidity inside the environments in this tree. That also has a huge impact on the bacterial community, the kinds of plant pathogens. Like, it's crazy. Like, just all the ecological consequences that are happening in this relationship. It's really neat.
Very fun.
That all makes sense too, but yeah, it's wild how extensive it is.
No, it's just crazy. You're just sitting there looking at a tree and not really thinking about the, epic, war between millions of organisms that's happening.
Yes.
You're just like, oh, it makes a whistling sound.
Oh, is that an ant?
And the ants are like, tonight we dine in hell. All right. Now, of course, one creature that is undeterred by the formic war zone is the Pottis monkey.
A little deterred because they don't sleep there.
That's true. They don't necessarily sleep there.
They're not afraid.
But they do love this tree. Mm-hmm. They crave the gum of the acacia tree, but also the ants within it, making an awkward third wheel for this fascinating mutualistic relationship. They basically exploit these trees exactly how you think a monkey would. They don't, they can more gracefully utilize them than a giraffe or an elephant. They're not just like trying to wrap their tongue around something. There are, they got monkey hands.
Yeah.
So they will just kind of reach up and they'll just like grab one of those swollen thorns, and I'll just snack on it. Nice. And it's like, it's like, ooh, crunchy crunch, first of all. Secondly, full of ants.
I was going to say, it sounds like they're eating the ants.
Yeah, they are. Okay. Yeah, that's part of it.
Where's the gum in the tree? It's under the bark, right? It's in like
The gum appears phloem. In like the exterior. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Like as the tree sustains any kind of damage or whatever, it starts putting out like a huge deposits of that gum on the outside.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like tree blood.
Tree blood.
Souped up. Num.
Yes.
Into gum. Cool.
Yes. Now, the acacia-dwelling ant species are actually a very key component, like a key supplement to this diet of the pontus monkey that focuses on all that gum eating, because the reproduction of those four species is completely asynchronous. So they're any time of year, there's going to be acacia trees that have a boatload of ants on them, regardless of what species took it over.
Sure.
So it's like the pontus monkey's in business, right? Also, it's kind of interesting, and I don't know if this is because of pontus monkeys that this happens, but you will actually see the ants kind of like the way they distribute themselves throughout a tree. It gets shifted around quite a bit. They will put, for example, the immature ants tend to be in the higher branches of the tree. You've got the alates, like the reproductive ants, like on the outside branches of the tree. You have the workers on the inside branches of the tree. So it's like, you know, I think for like colony sustainability, because they know these monkeys are just going to come like wandering around from time to time. And they're just like, you know, they don't care about all the thorns. They're just like, ooh, snack tree. And, you know, start munching on parts of it. They seem to kind of distribute themselves in a way to minimize the pain from that.
Do they have a preference on ant?
They have a preference, like what kind of ant they like?
Yeah.
They don't. Mm-hmm. They just want all the sweet snack.
Nice.
I did see one paper said that they will, pontus monkeys will continue to feed on these trees until it becomes too painful. Then they move on.
Nice. Painful in what way?
Hang on. I think just acid? Like painful in the face region, because like I watched some videos of
the face region.
I watched videos of both pontus monkeys using these trees and various naturalists like, you know, showing off the tree. As soon as you start messing with the branches, ants just pour out of this thing. Uh-huh. So like there'd be naturalists who were like, you know, oh, and here we have, you see, in the little, you know, the thorns, they have, they're bulbous, and, you know, they, and the, oh, well, I'm about to get completely put to death, so I'm going to step away from the tree now, you know, it's like, the monkeys are the same way, like, you can watch the videos, they're pulling, they're snacking, and there are ants just, like, crawling all over them, but they're just like, nom, 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 you know, they don't really care, they are just, you know, experiencing total bliss.
And pain in the face region. Wait, why are they okay with that, but other animals are not?
I don't know. That's a great question. Probably because there's, you know, I don't know. I never really found an explanation for why this tree in particular. And they will eat fruits from other trees, but it's like this tree is the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
80% of their diet.
They're much, I mean, at the most basic level, they're much fuzzier than like a giraffe.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And pontus monkeys are like pretty long furred. Mm-hmm. I sent both of you various monkey pictures early in the morning hours today. So.
You did?
Yeah.
I got one. You didn't even describe their mustache.
That's true. They are they have kind of like a very like fuzzy. They've first of all, okay, they have like whitish limbs, like white fur on their limbs. They've got orange fur on their tail. Their bodies, and then they do have like a very fluffy, fuzzy face. Mm-hmm. They're kind of almost like have a concave facial aspect, and then they've got like a
what
mustache.
Mustache.
How is a face concave?
Well, it's just, you know, the way their nose, like, you know, it it kind of scoops into the face a little bit.
It's very accurate.
I guess if your face isn't protruding out as much, there's. Slightly more space for the ants to not, you know, be able to just get up on your face when you're eating.
That's true. If you don't have like a really pronounced like rostrum, like a big snout coming out. Mm-hmm. I mean, like an elephant. Holy cow. Yeah. There's so much to bite there. Yeah. That's a fair
so
point.
So much to bite there.
Okay.
Oh my goodness.
An elephant could store thousands of ants in that nose. Like, who
store?
Like, as it's eating, it's getting attacked. Just thousands of ants just pour
marching
in there,
up. Yeah. Oh no.
Yes.
Stinging on the sensitive like mucus membranes inside your nose. Oh.
I do have a note on here, which says to address the question of whether or not an acacia thorn is a sandwich.
Excuse me?
Yes. Well, it is, you know, something with an edible outer exterior and an edible filling.
Yeah.
Which is ants.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it more like a puff pastry?
Yeah.
A puff pastry? Yeah.
But there's no flaky layers.
Is a puff pastry a sandwich?
No.
Oh.
Why? Are we like sandwich?
It's like a cake pop.
It is like
crunchy outside, sweet juicy inside.
Yeah.
Cake pops are not crunchy.
It's like a really spicy cake pop.
Like a cake pop dipped in... Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Mm. Good, 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 good.
Somebody out there would eat one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, this brings me to the ecological connection that this animal has with the entire world.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
The potus monkey. Uh-huh.
Okay. The world's involved. Is it because the world likes gum? We'll find out. Sorry, go ahead.
Based on a 2018 paper, it is now believed that the potus monkey and its BFF, the whistling thorn acacia, were the inspiration for the 1971 anti-capitalist eco-crusader fable, The Lorax.
Oh, okay.
there is significant evidence for this. So Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss, was actually on a vacation at the Mount Kenya Safari Club. In the September of 1970, he was experiencing severe writer's block at the time, and on this trip, he wrote the manuscript for The Lorax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the story as we know it, you have a small, grouchy, ape-like creature with a handsome set of mustaches, who has a very, you know, very close relationship to truffula trees, which are being, you know, devastated by the horrible Wunsler. Is that how it's pronounced?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think so.
I don't know if I've ever actually heard the book like read out loud. I didn't see the movie either. The Wunsler?
The Wunsler is, I think, what they say in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's just sort of, you know, taking over the trees. Now, so we've got, again, mustachioed monkey creature.
Uh-huh.
Very close relationship with the tree.
Orange.
Yes, orange, right. And the tree itself is economically valuable and being exploited by evil capitalist forces.
Yes.
Stands to reason that a potus monkey would be indeed the inspiration for that. The author of this paper, who, by the way, is a primatologist at Harvard, went to great lengths to demonstrate this hypothesis, including creating facial composites of of potus monkeys to try and illustrate that, yeah, this was probably the thing. They interviewed Dr. Seuss's widow, and she was like, I don't remember. Here I've got a little side-by-side picture of a variety of potus
monkeys.
Is it the
composite?
And our Lorax here, you know? I think there's a resemblance there.
That's the same animal, basically. If the Lorax had really massive mutton chops, sideburns, then it would just be the Lorax.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So now, of course, it's unlikely that that Dr. Seuss had really any concept of the intense, like, ecological tapestry that this tree and this monkey are a part of. But, you know, it makes it all the more appropriate that that it was chosen as the, you know, the inspiration for this story. Mm. If you were as a child, inspired to the cause of conservation and environmental justice by the Lorax, then perhaps the potus monkey is to thank for that.
Wow.
Yes.
Also, the potus monkey is way cuter than the Lorax.
It is true. It is a cute monkey. Mm-hmm. It's a silly little guy. Does it speak for the trees? I cannot say for sure. It does like to snack on them. Yes. Do you guys have any questions for me?
Do you think that the Lorax wants the trees to live so that he can abuse them himself?
Whoa,
the Pottus monkey.
Wow. Abuse them. First of all, I don't think constitutes abuse. Yeah, utilize them, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Why would he wouldn't want to, the Lorax wouldn't want to destroy the Truffula trees any more than a Pottus monkey would want to destroy the Acacia trees. Because then train's gone, you know?
Well, the ants do.
Look, it's all give and take. Mm-hmm. They help. I mean, they help spread these seeds, you know, through when they're eating, you know. So they're providing an ecological service as well here to the, you know, for the tree.
Sure,
probably at great distances too with that insane range.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yes. Wow. Are we just gonna move past the fact that you called Dr. Seuss Theodore like an absolute dork earlier?
That's his name.
Nobody says that, though.
All right. Feeling very attacked.
No.
I would just like to leave you with a thought.
Okay. Just one?
Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot.
Oh, my God.
Nothing's going to get better. It's not. So, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. A little information about the Pottus monkey, which is important, I would say. To the African savannah.
Yeah.
And a real delight.
And a real delight. Dancing monkeys.
Dancing monkeys.
Okay. Never seen a video of a Pottus monkey. I've seen pictures of them before.
Yeah. I watch a lot of video of them. They're just goofy. I like them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Monkeys are fun, Nicole. Let's you and me sit down, watch some monkey videos. That was the most belabored sigh. Okay.
Do we get a final rating from you on the Pottus monkey?
Like,
hold up. Let me hold up a picture of one again.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Out of five, and am I comparing it to other monkeys or am I comparing it to other animals in general?
Other monkeys.
Other monkeys, like a good 4.5
for sure.
Look at
all four of these faces.
Yeah, no, their mustache is really, well, that bottom right one's a little scary, but but like their mustaches are pretty good. The one that you sent me at like 4 a.m. was very good. I like their little pants. Yeah. They got fluffy pants. You know what they have? They have wired haired terrier energy, which is like my favorite dog.
Yeah.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
They have wired haired terrier energy and like their hair is very good.
This does, it does have a somewhat, yeah, like a canine looking coat, honestly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
My God, that mustache.
Very good.
You sent us monkey photos at 4 a.m.?
This is the one I sent to Rachel.
Oh my gosh.
That's a more gruff monkey.
Look at it. It's got really,
that monkey looks like Theodore Roosevelt.
It really does.
Yeah.
It uses like beard oil in that mustache for sure.
Do they groom their mustaches? Because they're just pointing straight out.
That's a great question. I don't know. Maybe there's some essential oils in all this acacia plant. That
they use the acacia gum.
Yeah. Oh, look at that sandwich.
Look at that delicious cake pop. All right. Well, that's all I got.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, guys.
And thanks to our listeners for listening to this wonderful podcast. The Best Biome is produced through our nonprofit Grassland Groupies, which is dedicated to inspiring the conservation of grasslands. In the show notes, you can find our website, phone number, and social media accounts. Feel free to text, call, or tweet us, including suggestions, fan mail, hate mail, whatever floats your boat. If you enjoyed the show and want to support us, tell your friends about us or leave us a review. We couldn't do this without your support. We really appreciate it. And we'll be back for this podcast next month with another episode. Bye.
Bye.
Monkeys are dumb.
Oh my God.